Good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Thank you for finding us. A, B, tuning in, and C, I hope you're going to stick around for a while. It's about 7 past the hour. Tomorrow is the 5th anniversary of George Bush's assault on a country unable to defend itself and who had done nothing to us. And there are events going on around the country tomorrow. If you're interested, there are two websites you can check, unitedforpeace.org, unitedforpeace.org, and 5yearstoomany.org. It's numeral 5, 5yearstoomany.org. You might want to check either or both of those websites. There are a tremendous amount of events occurring in New York City, New York State, and New Jersey, and around the rest of the country. So, UnitedForPeace.org, numeral 5, 5yearstoomany.org. If you were near a television today, perhaps you watched the speech. I certainly did. It was, as far as I'm concerned, it was one of the most important speeches regarding race probably made in this country since the I Have a Dream speech. As a matter of fact, it was essentially the same thing, only in less rhetorical flourishes from Barack Obama than Dr. King. Of course, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is and was unique in the way he spoke and what he said. But as far as I'm concerned, it was Barack Obama's talk today. His point of view on the race issue in this country was a good starting point. It took on issues that I didn't think any politician in this country would have the courage to take on. And it is, yes, a starting point if we want to pursue it. If perhaps this time, to kind of quote what Obama was saying, if this time we don't just turn away from the chance to take a look at all this. What was very upsetting to me was to hear the speech, to sit there and watch it, and a couple of times to be able to really hook into what he was saying on a personal level, which doesn't happen to me very often where it concerns speeches by politicians or would-be presidential candidates. That's a very rare thing to happen to me where I feel actually physically moved by what someone has said or is in the process of saying. It's one thing to go back and hear an historical speech that a famous politician or president in this country gave decades ago and to be moved by that speech, but to actually feel it in the moment while it's occurring is a rare, if not impossible, experience for me. Well, today I had a couple of those moments when Barack Obama was talking. And when he was finished, I flipped between CNN and Fox and MSNBC. I wanted to see what the white people had to say about it, the white commentators, and it was alarming and disturbing and disgusting, but there it was. To listen to Joe Scarborough or Brit Hume or Wolf Blitzer try to make comments, I have to say, of the three, Blitzer was the most neutral, which is not necessarily a good thing. But Brit Hume's smarmy attitude, looking at the camera, sitting there on his large ass, just making comments that were so totally disconnected to what just happened. Joe Scarborough, of all people, and Pat Buchanan, of all people, making comments and assessing and evaluating a speech by Barack Obama bordered on the, I don't know, the hallucinogenic to me. It was just, it was almost like doing acid and watching strange things dance in front of your eyes. I don't think I heard a single white commentator get it. Some of the black folk that were invited to offer up their opinions or make a defense of what Barack Obama had said, in most cases that's what they were asked to do, defend him. Not overtly, defend your man. It was more in the way the white people were making their statements. Although Sally Quinn, I have to say that Sally Quinn, a white woman, did on MSNBC make an assessment of the speech, I was surprised to hear coming from Sally Quinn. I tended to completely agree with what she was saying. But it was disconcerting, to say the least, to see white people once again taking something that this black man had said and that came from the heart, and tried to do it in a way that would just pry open a little bit white people's eyes. The so-called, how many times have I heard this today? Well, he's got to reach the blue-collar Reagan Democrats, and I don't think he did that with that speech today. You know, there's Obama trying, as black folk have to do when they're trying to show white people something, very cautiously, very slowly, so as not to freak the white person out, not to just freak him out completely. Barack Obama's references to what the black experience has been in this country were obviously, from an historical perspective, dead on. I mean, I can't address them because I'm not black. His references to the white experience in whatever resentments or envies or petty jealousies or vicious, mind-boggling, murderous attitudes towards black folk, that was kind of right on, too. He tried to pry that door open just a little bit so that white people could say, well, maybe this guy is not going to beat up on me because I'm white, because my ancestors did to his ancestors and all that other crap. I had a feeling that I was watching maybe the opening statements of a way, 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 way watered down Truth and Reconciliation Commission a la South Africa. The violence in South Africa, of course, and the jailing, the torturing of black leaders doesn't compare to anything that we've experienced here. We've experienced the lynchings and the murder and the mayhem and the butchery, but the state institutionalized apartheid that occurred in South Africa is not something that most Americans are familiar with, but it took a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Anyone who wanted to confess and ask for forgiveness was invited to do so without penalty of the law in South Africa. And a lot of blacks did. Some whites did. But I got the impression, listening to Barack Obama today, that it was a chance to really address this monster that has been haunting us now for 300 years in this country and is going to sadly continue to haunt us until we get real. And for the most part, that means white people get real, because we're the one, you know, black people didn't chain us up in Ireland or Scotland or Norway and bring us over here to work on their sugar plantations. You know, that's not what happened. But his point, and this is something that's always lost, I'm sorry to say, I've yet to meet white people, maybe one in 10,000 who get this. The perfect situation for Jeffersonian-style capitalism is to have a workforce you don't have to pay. And then when they get sick, you can flick them aside and they can die and there's no problem. And you can divide families according to the strongest ones and put them to work doing construction or working in the fields or whatever. The slave labor that was used to build white fortunes in this country is something that white people just don't understand. Just don't understand. And I'm not talking about the really rich, 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 mega rich, the plutocracy back in the 1800s. I'm just talking about family wealth. Black folk were never allowed, and Barack Obama tried to point this out today, black folk were not allowed to do that. They couldn't get a mortgage. They couldn't get a loan. They couldn't buy land. The few that were able to do that had to do it in such a guarded way, with so much caution and so much fear, because the Knight Riders would come eventually and burn them out. You know, how dare you own property? How dare, what do you think, you're white? White people, on the other hand, never had that situation to deal with. If white people chose to be lazy or stupid or ignorant or sharecroppers or uneducated, and not always was the choice made, sometimes it was made for them, I certainly acknowledge that, they still had one thing going for them, and that was their ability to totally assimilate. And at some point, if they chose, the white people chose to so-called pull themselves up by the bootstraps, there are always all sorts of institutions waiting to help them, whether it was Small Business Association or loans or FHA or college tuition. And Barack Obama tried to make a very salient point today. Black folk were denied that. You are my still human. The future is known.
Hands and feet are all in line.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves.
Let's see. There I was sitting around the leader with the table with foreign leaders, looking at Colin Powell and Condie Rice. Yeah.
I bet you were. I bet you were, Chuckle Nuts. 21 past the hour. The impact of Barack Obama's speech today, I think, will be missed by most white people because white people are used to not hearing what black folks say. That's come on, you know that's true. How long did it take the I Have a Dream speech to really sink in? There were 300,000 people in D.C. on that day in 19, when was it, Kathy? 63. But how many white people really paid any attention to it? I think what Barack Obama was trying to do today is to expand it way past just stone cold racial divisions in this country. He tried to bridge the gap. This is a guy who really could bridge the gap, too. You know, given his parentage, giving his family makeup, like he said today, he has all shades in his family. What better man to open the door for this? Because, see, here's the thing that white people better understand. Here's a guy, just a guy, Barack Obama. One parent was black, one parent was white. Okay. And we call him a black man. Now, let's suppose we had somebody else, one parent black, one parent white, and the second guy looked more, quote, white, end quote. You see? But the background would be the same. Who do you think white America would be more inclined to listen to, the whiter-looking guy or the darker-looking guy? Come on, you know the answer to this. Now, I'm talking about people. I would assume there's a generational thing here. There is a huge generational thing here, just like when Barack Obama was talking about his preacher, that he comes from a generation that still can feel that horrible sting. His preacher was a Marine, for Christ's sake. Hosea Williams, who was a civil rights activist here in Atlanta, and I knew for years before he died, Hosea Williams was in the Army. He was in France in World War II. He was wounded. He was a soldier. He was a combat veteran. And he came back, and he got elected to city council. He got elected to this, got elected to that. But before he did that, he owned a chemical company down near Savannah, Georgia. But he used to tell a story when he came back from fighting for the U.S. Constitution, because that's what a soldier swears to uphold. I know that's not what why the soldier fights. He fights for his buddy on the battlefield, but he swears to uphold the Constitution. And how Hosea Williams, on his first day back, and guys back in World War II, whether white or black, were in, I believe the phrase was, for the duration. I can remember one of my uncles coming home from World War II, and he talked about how during the war he used to come home on furlough. I was a little kid at the time. I didn't know what the hell a furlough was. It sounded like something scary. But Hosea Williams, who came back periodically from combat and finally got discharged and trying to get off the boat in Roanoke, Virginia, Tidewater, Virginia, whatever port he came, Norfolk, whatever port he came into, and then to take a train from Norfolk down to Savannah and what he had to go through. And how he tried to explain, look, you know, I've just come back from a combat zone. I'm on crutches because I was wounded in combat fighting for America. So Barack Obama's preacher, who is a former Marine, obviously had the same kind of experience. Now, that's something that white people can never, ever, 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 under any circumstances, ever really connect to. It's impossible. It's utterly impossible. And for people in that generation, most of whom are dead now, World War II vets, there are not that many left around, but just using the military as a template, all the black Americans who have fought for the Constitution, that's what they were told when they took their oath. Of course, a lot of folks understood that the wars after World War II were not about defending the Constitution. They're about defending corporate America. But all of these issues, I think Barack Obama tried honestly and genuinely and from the heart, without political rhetoric or without kicking anybody's ass, I think he tried to just look. I'm not going to throw this guy under the bus. I know he said some pretty intense things, but from his point of view, they're true. And I, Mike Malloy, as a white man, looked at these sermons, at least the excerpts that everybody else has looked at, over and over and over and over and over again. And just like Martin Luther King's speech all those years ago at Riverside Church in New York, I didn't find anything. There was not a lie in anything Obama's preacher said. Certainly not a lie for me as a Caucasian to comment on, because the Reverend was talking from the black experience. When he says, "God damn America," not "God bless America," well, what? Well, okay, really, really. Absolutely. What is it that white people can't, in that statement, based on the black experience, that white folks can't get their minds around? What is it about that that causes people like Pat Buchanan or Brit Hume or the rest of these white commentators on television to say, well, that's anti-American? No, it wasn't. It wasn't anti-American at all. But I have a hard time understanding why white people, since I am one, can't just understand on an intellectual level what black folks are talking about. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Sunday, the noise shook the ground, and people all over the earth turned around. For no one recalled a more cowardly sound, and the choir kept singing for freedom.
Radical Talk Radio, make mine Mike Malloy on Nova M.
Why 25 before the hour, we are going to play some excerpts from Barack Obama's speech today. We're going to talk about this a little bit tonight, so if you're not interested in this, I certainly understand. But I think the event today was important enough. I think what was talked about today, or what was brought out for discussion today, and sadly probably will not be discussed on the level of discussion necessary, is important. It's important nonetheless. A couple of emails here, and then we're going to play some sound for you. This is from Bridget. Regarding Obama, he did what no other politician has done for decades. He went straight into the wound. In therapy, you learn that you can't heal a festering wound until you have the courage to open the damn infected thing up and step fully into the pain of it. I think Obama did that today, and no matter what I might feel about his positions on some things, I have unending respect for his courage to do what he did. The enormity of that speech is probably only apparent if you compare it to the other political rhetoric of our day, and it should be the standard, not the rare exception. But it's here. It did happen. I personally hope that we get 8 years of it with actions to match. This is from Josh Epstein in New York City, the Joshua blog. Dear media, that this New York Jew knew in his bones that what Barack Obama was saying was more powerful than some of the right-wing pundits are obviously capable of giving him credit for. I actually welled up several times during the speech. At a couple of points, I even had to stop what I was doing while he was speaking and sit down because my knees wobbled. That's not an exaggeration. This is much more than just about Reverend Wright's words, which I also happen to think have some validity. It was about a truth this country hasn't been willing to face head-on from any point of view along the color spectrum. This speech will be looked back upon in a greater light than even JFK's religious speech. 50 years from now, naysayers and racists who are alive and, well, all over the networks, and who can still only focus on Wright's words, will be forgotten. Just like the anti-Catholics who were after JFK's historical speech. The media have a decision to make now. Do you continue limiting the discussion to Reverend Wright's fiery words, or do you open conversation to the bigger, more important historical truth of racial and economic injustices that are real, still alive, and thriving in both the black and white communities? I suspect, Joshua writes, the Pat Buchanan, Sean Hannity's, and Joe Scarborough's of the world will choose the former. But who of you out there will be courageous enough to choose the latter? Don't hold your breath, Joshua. One thing about television news media, they do not like peace. They want conflict, whether it is between two people screaming at each other on television or a war. Television is not about showing you people getting along. Television does not go into Tibet except to show the bloodshed that's going on there now. It doesn't go into the Venezuelan, Colombian, Ecuadorian border except with the just mouth-breathing anticipation that somebody's going to get froggy and jump and there will be bloodshed. They don't go, nor are they, the media, interested in stories of peace, love, and how did the cynics put it? Oh, kumbaya. No, no. That's not what they're about. They're about conflict, not conflict resolution. So, Joshua, forget it. News media are going to play the Reverend Wright speech until hell freezes over and George Bush is down there ice skating. This is from Stephanie in Cleveland. I'm writing in regards to Obama's speech today. I must say I was very impressed. It was very courageous of him to expose the racial elephant in the living room the way he did. I could not agree more with him. I especially liked how he called out the corporate media and corporate America and talked about how they try to distract us from the real issues facing America with divisive non-issues. I fear, however, knowing what I have seen from the average American, that will fall on mostly deaf ears. Americans do not want to think about the blemish of racism that is still on this country even today. It is too hard and requires taking responsibility and honest self-reflection. People may have to face their own individual prejudices, and it's very difficult for most people to challenge their own realities. Obama's speech was the most honest speech I've heard about race in years. I wonder how the corporate media will spin this. I'm sure they will continue to focus on his pastor, the Reverend Wright, and continue to ask, well, why did he stay in that church for 20 years? Those who do ask that question clearly are not able to comprehend what Obama said and are unreachable. I would also like to add that the Reverend Wright served as a U.S. Marine. He served this country only to be told we could not go to the same school with pure and clean white children, only to be told he was not human enough to vote because of the color of his skin, only to be discriminated against with words like, and then she uses the N-word, does this man not have a right to criticize this country he served? I'm so tired of the false patriotism and extreme nationalism that has become pervasive in this country. Next time I hear someone say something about patriotism, I will ask them what they've done for this country lately. Most likely, they will not have an answer, because it's usually those who scream loudest about patriotism that sacrifice the least. America's response to Obama's speech today will reveal what kind of country we live in. It can either start the process of healing racism in this country, or it can expose the deep-down prejudice, ugliness, and hatefulness that would tear us apart even further. I hope for the former, but prepare for the latter. Stephanie in Cleveland. And Reverend John Deckenbach, who is a conference minister for the UCC, United Church of Christ, that's the same denomination that Reverend Jeremiah Wright belongs to, Reverend Deffenbach said today, UCC, United Church of Christ, has in its DNA from its very beginnings being responsible critics of our society. That's rooted in the Amistad story, which holds a special place in UCC's teachings. There is a need for criticism of this society. Why is the prison population totally disproportionately ethnic minorities? Such questions need to be raised here and internationally. Some of the language that individual ministers might use might make some uncomfortable, but to get to the point of repentance, you've got to acknowledge your misdeed. Unfortunately, we in the United States sometimes act like we're God's gift to the world. I just came back from Iraq and saw the results of the devastation our government's policies have brought. If Martin Luther King Jr. were alive, he'd be saying once again, shame on you for what you've wrought. And then there's the Reverend Graylin Hagler. He's a national president of Ministers for Racial, Social, and Economic Justice of the UCC. He's also the senior minister of the Plymouth Congregation of the United Church of Christ in Washington, D.C. Reverend Hagler said today, part of what I'm finding is that many people do not understand what prophetic speech is. Critiques of the war or of racial injustice involve or invoke prophetic speech. Prophetic speech, by its very nature, is provocative. We need to be wary of attacks that might muzzle the black church. If we did not have prophetic speech, we would not have the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We would not have had Micah. We would not have had Jeremiah. And we would not have had Jesus Christ himself. King spoke of the United States being, quote, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, end quote. He focused on the Vietnam War and against economic injustice in the year before he was killed. And when he talked to those issues, he suddenly found that people who had been supporting him suddenly started attacking him. You cannot repent unless you make a confession. We have to make a confession to deal with racism or sexism or xenophobia, both individually and collectively. Prophetic speech is a way that forces us to a place of moral responsibility. And then I have an excerpt here from King's sermon, Ebenezer Baptist Church, right here in Atlanta, April 30th, 1967. He said, "Don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be, a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, 'You're too arrogant. And if you don't change your ways, I will raise up and break the backbone of your power, and I'll place it in the hands of a nation that doesn't even know my name.'" There's something strangely inconsistent, Dr. King said, about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward Sheriff Jim Clark," but will curse and damn you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children." There's something wrong with that press. Now, Barack Obama, about race in America today, he spoke from Philadelphia, interestingly, across the street, I believe, from Independence Hall. And as you know, by now, he discussed the controversy surrounding the minister of his church, Reverend Jeremiah Wright. And the first bit of sound we're going to play for you when we come back from this break will be his condemnation of Reverend Wright's statements. But, of course, he explains also why he can't abandon him. And, you know, that makes sense. But I heard Pat Buchanan and Joe Scarborough and the punkish, who's the guy at Fox that I mentioned earlier? I forget his name because Brit Hume, I never watch that channel. It was very weird to tune it on today. But this is the part that they couldn't let go of. These white men couldn't let go of. They expected Barack Obama to stand up and say, "Listen, Reverend Wright is a rotten son of a bitch, communist, dirty, filthy, terrorist-loving, skunk, punk, liar. I hate him. I hate his mama. I hate his mama's mama. I hate his children, his offspring, all of his family. And I'd like to get a divorce so I can get remarried by somebody who doesn't hate America the way this son of a bitch does." That's the impression I got today listening to these white men. That's what they wanted Barack Obama to say. Because, you know, they would have said something like that if a member of their racial group had said something disparaging about blacks. Right?
Every time I turn on the TV, somebody's acting crazy. If you let it, it'll drive you crazy. I'm taking back my power today. Gas prices, they just keep on rising. The government, they keep on lying. We gotta keep on surviving. Keep living our truth and do.
Ten before the hour, Barack Obama at the speech today. This is the part where he condemns Reverend Jeremiah Wright's statements, but explains why he can't throw him under the proverbial bus.
"I have already condemned in unequivocal terms the statements of Reverend Wright that have caused such controversy. Reverend Wright's comments were not only wrong, but divisive. Divisive at a time when we need unity. Racially charged at a time when we need to come together to solve a set of monumental problems. Given my background, my politics, and my professed values and ideals, there will no doubt be those for whom my statements of condemnation are not enough. Why associate myself with Reverend Wright in the first place, they may ask? Why not join another church? And I confess that if all that I knew of Reverend Wright were the snippets of those sermons that have run in an endless loop on the television sets and YouTube, if Trinity United Church of Christ conformed to the caricatures being peddled by some commentators, there is no doubt that I would react in much the same way. But the truth is, that isn't all that I know of the man. The man I met more than 20 years ago is a man who helped introduce me to my Christian faith. A man who spoke to me about our obligations to love one another, to care for the sick, and lift up the poor. He is a man who served his country as a United States Marine, and who has studied and lectured at some of the finest universities and seminaries in the country. And this helps explain, perhaps, my relationship with Reverend Wright. As imperfect as he may be, he has been like family to me. He strengthened my faith, officiated my wedding, and baptized my children. Not once in my conversations with him have I heard him talk about any ethnic group in derogatory terms, or treat whites with whom he interacted with anything but courtesy and respect. He contains within him the contradictions, the good and the bad, of the community that he has served diligently for so many years. I can no more disown him than I can disown the black community. I can no more disown him than I can disown my white grandmother, a woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed her by on the street, and who on more than one occasion has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe. These people are part of me, and they are part of America, this country that I love.
The part is that is unbelievably difficult for so many white male commentators in television, given the rat's nest that television has become. The most difficult part for these white men to understand is the truth of what Barack Obama is saying. There's got to be a punchline, they think. There's got to be something else, they insist. Well, he didn't completely disavow the Reverend whoever, they say. Because it's the honesty. Tell me, point out to me, please point out to me. A white opinion maker, whether it's a politician or somebody in the commentariat or just anyone, point out to me one of these white men who will say the same thing Barack Obama is saying. Just one. Who acknowledges the fear and loathing that exists, but also has the courage to say, this is part of who we are. We can deal with this. We can get past this. We can move beyond these racial and ethnic stereotypes. We can do it. What do you say? These people are a part of me. They're a part of America, the country that I love. But you see, in my opinion, only someone like Barack Obama could make a statement or a speech like this today. Tell me another white politician who could do it, or a white politician who could do this. Go ahead. I'm going to hear. Send me an email. What white politician could do this? And don't cite the usual crowd of liberals, of white liberals, because they can't either. They can't do it. They can't do it. And that's because the reason they can't is first and foremost because of who they are. They have been on the giving end of all this crap for all these centuries, not on the receiving end. And you know what I'm talking about? I'm talking about the denial of basic human rights. When you're on the giving end, you have a whole different outlook than on the receiving end. When you walk around with nothing but a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And that's what's been going on. And to me, this is one of the reasons that Barack Obama's speech today was so damned important, as low-key as it was. He wasn't waving his arms. He didn't throw his head back. He wasn't pounding the podium. He wasn't using flowery, high-flown rhetoric. Just a man standing there talking about this deep, nasty wound that still exists in this country. We've got some more from him when we come back after this break. We're going to talk about other things tonight, but I just think it's so important to get this out here on this little old radio talk show. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. Welcome back. It's almost 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy Program on the Nova M Radio Network. We're talking about the speech today given by Barack Obama addressing the issue of race in this country. The one of the issues that simply will not go away. It's my impression that a lot of folks who heard this today are, and I'm not talking about white people, I'm talking about black people here. White people look at it with a kind of cynicism because it didn't live up to their standards. And their standards were a complete denunciation of Reverend Jeremiah Wright, which was simply not going to happen, and no reason for it to happen. In my opinion, none whatsoever. Because again, in listening to the rhetoric, I don't know what he said that was not true. It is true. Anyone who understands the history of this country, our history of foreign policy and the way we treat the rest of the world, and our history of domestic policy and how we treat people of color in this country, would have no problem with what he said from a factual standpoint. May have a lot of problem with the reality of it, but from a factual standpoint, show me a lie. Show me a lie. You can email me. Show me a lie in what he said. But to a lot of white people who just simply cannot handle the truth. The truth that Dr. King talked about. We are not God's gift to the world. We don't have manifest destiny. We really, really don't. We're just one clump of people, all immigrants, who came over here, beat the living hell out of the people who already had this place, and built our own society, and used a bunch of black folk to help us build it. I'm talking about white people here. And then declare it's ours, and we're going to go out and kick the rest of the world's ass because they have stuff we want. Oil, rubber, tin, diamonds, gold, doesn't make any difference. It's ours. Give it to me. Give it to me. That's the history of the United States in 14 seconds. But the white folks whose job it is to parse what anybody says, but especially what a black politician says or a black leader says. That's the job of the white folks. The white folks' job is to take what the black man says, or the black woman, or the black person, whatever, it doesn't matter, especially if it's a point of view that is not in keeping with the white overview. And the job of the white person is to take the black man's speech and parse it down. Okay, well, what did he say here? Mm-hmm. Well, did he go far enough here? Mm-mm. Well, over here, did he? Nah. See, that's anti-American. Well, see, that's that's against the flag. Well, no, see, over here, he sounds like a communist. Look what they did to Dr. King. Dr. King was a communist. Oh, yeah. They had pictures of him at a communist training camp in North Carolina. Ooh, Lord have mercy. So what happened today? Immediately after the speech, there were a couple of white men who were kind of a little bit stunned because they got smacked right in the face with reality that wasn't aggressive. There was nothing that Barack Obama said that was aggressive. Nothing. So the only complaint they could come up with, well, he didn't, you know, in my neighborhood, no, I don't think so. In my neighborhood, he should have said that Reverend Jeremiah Wright was a punk, and he didn't say that. So, no pass. I'm sorry. Sorry, Brock, you didn't make it. No, wash out. And I'm sitting in front of the television watching this after the speech. I'm still trying to recover from the honesty and the straightforwardness of that speech. And I'm listening to these white commentators thinking, holy jumping Christ, this is one of those moments where I'm ashamed to be a Caucasian. Well, not really, because they're not me and I'm not them. But you know what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying. Obama then explained why race is an issue that continues to divide us. And he gave a history to explain the anger expressed in some of Reverend Wright's sermons, because part of our union, guess what, is not yet perfect.
But race is an issue that I believe this nation cannot afford to ignore right now. We would be making the same mistake that Reverend Wright made in his offending sermons about America, to simplify and stereotype and amplify the negative to the point that it distorts reality. The fact is that the comments that have been made and the issues that have surfaced over the last few weeks reflect the complexities of race in this country that we've never really worked through, a part of our union that we have not yet made perfect. And if we walk away now, if we simply retreat into our respective corners, we will never be able to come together and solve challenges like health care or education or the need to find good jobs for every American. Understanding this reality requires a reminder of how we arrived at this point. As William Faulkner once wrote, the past isn't dead and buried. In fact, it isn't even past. We do not need to recite here the history of racial injustice in this country. But we do need to remind ourselves that so many of the disparities that exist between the African-American community and the larger American community today can be traced directly to inequalities passed on from an earlier generation that suffered under the brutal legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. Segregated schools were and are inferior schools. We still haven't fixed them 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education. And the inferior education they provided, then and now, helps explain the pervasive achievement gap between today's black and white students. Legalized discrimination, where blacks were prevented, often through violence, from owning property, or loans were not granted to African-American business owners, or black homeowners could not access FHA mortgages, or blacks were excluded from unions, or the police force, or the fire department, meant that black families could not amass any meaningful wealth to bequeath to future generations. That history helps explain the wealth and income gap between blacks and whites, and the concentrated pockets of poverty that persist in so many of today's urban and rural communities. A lack of economic opportunity among black men, and the shame and frustration that came from not being able to provide for one's family, contributed to the erosion of black families, a problem that welfare policies for many years may have worsened, and the lack of basic services in so many urban black neighborhoods, parks for kids to play in, police walking the beat, regular garbage pickup, building code enforcement, all helped create a cycle of violence, blight, and neglect that continues to haunt us.
And that's such an important point that he just made, and he said it in such an offhand way. The lack of basic services in so many black neighborhoods, parks for kids to play in, police on the beat, garbage pickup, building code enforcement, all of it. You know, the white folks just don't quite can't get their minds around. Here in Atlanta, I can walk into a supermarket. I live in a racially mixed neighborhood, but I can walk into a neighborhood supermarket, Kroger. It doesn't make any difference what it is. That is in a neighborhood that is exclusively or predominantly middle class or a lower middle class black neighborhood, and I can go back to the dairy section, and I can open up the dairy, the door to the milk and the half and half and the cottage cheese, and I will pull out a half gallon, and I will look at the expiration date, and I will be damned if today is the 19th, the expiration date on that gallon of milk will say the 18th. I can do the same thing in the same chain, walk into a predominantly white or all white, exclusively white neighborhood, and the expiration date on that half gallon of milk is 3 weeks from now. Now, that's what I'm talking about. That's the kind of stuff, you see, that the average white person misses completely. Well, black folk don't miss that. They don't miss that. They know where that milk comes from. That comes from the white store that say, well, looks like we're going to have an oversupply of milk this week. Dump it over in the Negro section.
Got my long government letters, my time to go. When I got to the army, found the same old Jim Crow. Uncle Sam says, two camps for black and white.
Frankly, in the vote I got in the African American community, I put people in my cabinet. I put people in my sub cabinet.
Past the hour. We are talking about Barack Obama's speech today, the More Perfect Union speech that he gave in Philadelphia. Moving on, Obama then explained why race is an issue. He then detailed, how misguided anger in some white communities, fueled by these filthy, my word, conservative talk show hosts and fear-mongering politicians, have deepened this racial divide and masked the real culprit of all middle-class problems, which is corporate greed. You know, the old divide and conquer, it's so old, it's disgusting that we still fall for it. But the ruling elite sets us down here in the valleys, sets us against each other, whether it's black and white, Jew or Gentile, whatever it is, gay or straight, sets us each other's throats while they continue to rape and pillage with nobody paying attention, because we're all down here screaming racial epithets or talking about sexual orientations or religion, And the corporate elites are up there going, yeah, okay. As soon as you wear that one out, we got another one for you. Whites upset that blacks might, through affirmative action, get their jobs, should instead look at the reason why so many U.S. jobs are being shipped overseas. That's an example of uniting. It's so old. Fight the common enemy.
A similar anger exists within segments of the white community. Most working and middle-class white Americans don't feel that they've been particularly privileged by their race. Their experience is the immigrant experience. As far as they're concerned, no one handed them anything. They've built it from scratch. They've worked hard all their lives, many times only to see their jobs shipped overseas or their pensions dumped after a lifetime of labor. They are anxious about their futures, and they feel their dreams slipping away. And in an era of stagnant wages and global competition, opportunity comes to be seen as a zero-sum game in which your dreams come at my expense. So when they are told to bus their children to a school across town, when they hear an African American is getting an advantage in landing a good job or a spot in a good college because of an injustice that they themselves never committed, when they're told that their fears about crime in urban neighborhoods are somehow prejudice, resentment builds over time. Like the anger within the black community, these resentments aren't always expressed in polite company. But they have helped shape the political landscape for at least a generation. Anger over welfare and affirmative action helped forge the Reagan coalition. Politicians routinely exploited fears of crime for their own electoral ends. Talk show hosts and conservative commentators built entire careers unmasking bogus claims of racism while dismissing legitimate discussions of racial injustice and inequality as mere political correctness or reverse racism. And just as black anger often proved counterproductive, so have these white resentments distracted attention from the real culprits of the middle class squeeze, a corporate culture rife with inside dealing, questionable accounting practices, and short-term greed, a Washington dominated by lobbyists and special interests, economic policies that favor the few over the many. And yet to wish away the resentments of white Americans, to label them as misguided or even racist, without recognizing they are grounded in legitimate concerns, this too widens the racial divide and blocks the path to understanding.
And it's that very action that is just part and parcel. It is the heart and soul of all conservative or right-wing talk radio and talk television. A constant, unending effort to divide and conquer. If people could ever get together, how long do you think a pig like Rush Limbaugh would be allowed to continue to do what he does? Or a chump like Sean Hannity? Or any of these people who, with their very often subtle, coded language, continue to pound everything that they can pound with their filthy hammers? How long do you think? And there are common causes that we should all be fighting. Black, white, Jew, Gentile, gay, straight, men and women. Because corporate America loves to exploit all these differences, which, as you know, you see, keeps our eye off the real enemy. It's so slick, it just makes me greasy talking about it.
tension in the air. Racism, violence everywhere. Dangerous policies, bumpers, and brawling. Hit a halt now. Is it really racial justice? It's time that we discuss this. I'm disgusted.
Listen, this nation is committed to dealing with poverty. First, let me make it very clear. Poor people aren't necessarily killers. Just because you happen to be not rich doesn't mean you're willing to kill.
God. 25 before the hour. The biggest threat in Barack Obama's speech today was the possibility that these divisions that just eat at America would be overcome. That's the biggest threat to the power elite, because if we could ever stop bickering down here in the swamps and realize really what's going on by the corporate elites and the military-industrial power structure and on and on. I don't have to go down the list. You know what I'm talking about. If we could ever, lift our gaze up out of the muck and realize what the hell is going on, that they take our people and put them in illegal wars, that they put us in the trick bag where it concerns public education, laugh at us where it concerns clean air and water and soil. It's incredible. So the power structure, to use a term out of the 60s, or the corporate elites, understand something very clearly. And that is, as long as we're worried about, whether or not the black man or the white man is going to get a little bit more than I'm going to get, or whether or not the black woman or the white woman is going to get favorable treatment when she applies for a job, as long as we're worried about that, as long as we're talking about these dirty, filthy immigrants who just want to come in and repair our driveways and work in construction, as long as we're focused on that, or those damn gay people who want to do something as horrifying as get married, as long as we're focused on that, you see, the game goes on. And the sad fact is that, you play the game long enough and you tend to forget that it's a game. Back to the speech. What Obama believes will begin to heal the racial divides in this country, what each party, and he's not talking about political parties, must try to do to bridge this divide.
This is where we are right now. It's a racial stalemate we've been stuck in for years. And contrary to the claims of some of my critics, black and white, I have never been so naive as to believe that we can get beyond our racial divisions in a single election cycle or with a single candidate, particularly a candidacy as imperfect as my own. But I have asserted a firm conviction. A conviction rooted in my faith in God and my faith in the American people, that working together, we can move beyond some of our old racial wounds, and that, in fact, we have no choice. We have no choice if we are to continue on the path of a more perfect union. For the African-American community, that path means embracing the burdens of our past without becoming victims of our past. It means continuing to insist on a full measure of justice in every aspect of American life. But it also means binding our particular grievances for better health care and better schools and better jobs to the larger aspirations of all Americans. The white woman struggling to break the glass ceiling. The white man who's been laid off. The immigrant trying to feed his family. And it means also taking full responsibility for our own lives, by demanding more from our fathers and spending more time with our children and reading to them and teaching them that while they may face challenges and discrimination in their own lives, they must never succumb to despair or cynicism. They must always believe that they can write their own destiny. Now, in the white community, the path to a more perfect union means acknowledging that what ails the African-American community does not just exist in the minds of black people. that the legacy of discrimination and current incidents of discrimination, while less overt than in the past, that these things are real and must be addressed, not just with words, but with deeds, by investing in our schools, in our communities, by enforcing our civil rights laws and ensuring fairness in our criminal justice system, by providing this generation with ladders of opportunity that were unavailable for previous generations. It requires all Americans to realize that your dreams do not have to come at the expense of my dreams, that investing in the health, welfare, and education of black and brown and white children will ultimately help all of America prosper.
That's so basic, so elemental, so almost down at a kindergarten level. And yet, it continues to escape us, doesn't it? I frankly think it continues, for the most part, to escape white people. Again, I cannot speak to or of the black experience because I am not black. But I damn sure can talk about the white experience. And what Barack Obama is talking about, when he talks about teaching black children that, what did he say, that while they must face challenges and discrimination in their own lives, they must never succumb to despair or cynicism. After I heard the speech today, Molly was still in preschool. And Kathy was awesome. Somewhere. Hadn't come back to pick me up to go in and pick up Molly. And I started thinking about Molly. And I was thinking about what if I had to teach her on two different tracks. First of all, I had to teach her to be aggressive in not in a belligerent kind of way, but aggressive in the sense that, look, young lady, you can do anything you want to do. All you have to do is apply yourself, work hard, do what you have to do. You know, as long as mom and daddy are alive, we will help you. But the time will come when you have to do this on your own. And what if so far that's fine. That's what we all teach our children. Do you know black parents have to take it to another level, especially when they're dealing with sons? Are you aware of that? Are white people aware of that? I don't know. The only reason I'm aware of it is because I grew up with black children, and we used to talk about this. The black mother or father has to say the same thing to their children. I want you to excel. I want you to be aggressive. I want you to study. I want you to understand you can do or be anything you want to do or be. But you also have to understand that you're the minority, that white folks have the power. You've got to be careful. You've got to watch out. When you're walking down the street, when you're 14 and you're a black boy, be careful if you're walking down the street with two of your friends. If the police stop, whatever you do, don't run. Just stand there. Answer the cop's question. You see, that kind of thing. Now, for the most part, white people don't have to go through that. White parents don't have to go through that. So when Barack talks about facing challenges and discrimination in their own lives, they must never succumb to despair or cynicism. He's talking about something for black children that white children just don't face.
To the other side, 41 shots cut through the night. You're kneeling over his body in the vestibule, praying for his life. Well, is it a gun? Is it a knife? Is it a wallet? This is your life. It ain't no secret. No secret, my friend. You get killed just for living. You're American.
It's about 12 before the hour. All right, this is the last one. You'll be able to hear the entire speech in a number of sources, I'm sure, or you'll be able to hear edited versions that are tailored to make a particular point. In this last bite, Barack Obama looks to the future and he offers a choice to remain stagnant and ignore problems of race, or we can confront the issues and fight the common problems that underlie all of our problems, regardless of whether we're black, white, Latino, whatever. And to me, this was the most important part of what he had to say.
We have a choice in this country. We can accept a politics that breeds division and conflict and cynicism. We can play Reverend Wright's sermons on every channel every day and talk about them from now until the election and make the only question in this campaign whether or not the American people think that I somehow believe or sympathize with his most offensive words. We can pounce on some gaffe by a Hillary supporter as evidence that she's playing the race card. Or we can speculate on whether white men will all flock to John McCain in the general election, regardless of his policies. We can do that. But if we do, I can tell you that in the next election, we'll be talking about some other distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And then another one. And then another one. And nothing will change. That is one option. Or, at this moment, in this election, we can come together and say, not this time. This time we want to talk about the crumbling schools that are stealing the future of black children and white children and Asian children and Hispanic children and Native American children. Not this time. This time we want to talk about how the lines in the emergency room are filled with whites and blacks and Hispanics who do not have health care, who don't have the power on their own to overcome the special interests in Washington, but who can take them on if we do it together. This time, we want to talk about the shuttered mills that once provided a decent life for men and women of every race, and the homes for sale that once belonged to Americans from every religion, every region, every walk of life. This time, we want to talk about the fact that the real problem is not that someone who doesn't look like you might take your job. It's that the corporation you work for will ship it overseas for nothing more than a profit. This time, we want to talk about the men and women of every color and creed who serve together and fight together and bleed together under the same proud flag. We want to talk about how to bring them home from a war that should have never been authorized and should have never been waged. And we want to talk about how we'll show our patriotism by caring for them and their families and giving them the benefits that they have earned. I would not be running for president if I didn't believe with all my heart that this is what the vast majority of Americans want for this country.
And to that, of course, we can all say a huge amen. But, yeah, there's always a but. The problem, and this is where the Malloy cynicism, you know, rises up. As inspiring as Barack Obama's speech is, as low-key as it was inspiring on the one hand, low-key on the other. He didn't get into the call-and-response thing that can move an audience, that can make all of us, black or white, well, not all white people. Some white people just sit there and go, oh, I don't know what's going on. But that call-and-response thing that can get people moving and rocking, that emotional thing that happens where it's not just words, it gets inside you and moves you around, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. He didn't do that. He could have. He didn't. It would have been, in my opinion, more powerful, but it would have been more racially identifiable. You understand what I'm saying with that? I'm sure you do. So the cynicism that has become almost oxygen to me because of what I have witnessed, especially these last 7 years, the cynicism is going to be hard for me to overcome. I'm trying. I am trying like crazy to not lose faith, to not lose hope in this country, in what we're about. The very thing that Barack Obama, this is why the speech got to me in such a profound way today. What he was talking about. That the framers said, in order to reach a more perfect union, and to listen to Barack Obama in his very low-key, just kind of measured way, talk about this. You know, there was a teaching moment. A lesser candidate would have run and hidden from, like Jesse Jackson did with the Hymietown statements by Minister Farrakhan back when Jackson was running for president all those years ago. And the fruit of Islam would show up, either invited or uninvited, at Jesse Jackson rallies and stand there to give the impression of defending Jesse Jackson or protecting Jesse Jackson. But Barack Obama didn't do that. He didn't run and hide. He didn't say, wait a second, let me out of here. I have nothing to do with this. The man speaks for himself. He didn't do that. He confronted it. And the thing about Barack Obama that has made a lasting impression on me with that speech today was the fact that while he was able to repudiate some of the fire in the words of the reverend, and I don't necessarily think that was all that necessary, even though he was able to do that, Barack Obama did not toss the man to the wolves. He didn't do it. And he didn't do it, I think, for a very essential reason. Because he's part of Barack Obama's family. And the very weird thing to me today, because again, I'm being the cynical bastard that I am. All of a sudden today, towards the end of that speech, even though I was resisting like crazy, all of a sudden towards the end of that speech, I'll be damned if I didn't start to feel like part of Barack Obama's family. Whew. So, you wanted to add something, Ms. Bay?
I was going to say, but he didn't renounce Reverend White. And he admitted that he sat there while, Reverend White spouted hate and stuff in the
White?
Sermon. So,
Reverend
Wright.
Right.
Oh, yeah, whatever. So, it was just,
so you're going to vote for McCain anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I'm voting for McCain now.
Yeah. Come back on real quick and say you're kidding.
I am kidding.
I certainly hope so. All right. We have our top of the hour break here. When we come back, just a couple more comments on the speech today from you folks. And then we'll go to your phone calls. All right. Fair enough. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.
story in your eyes. It's been shining down upon me now.
Welcome back. About 7 past the hour. Couple emails here, and then we're going to come to your calls. The number is 800-989-1480. If you have some comments on the Barack Obama speech, that would be cool. Jane writes, the media are pissed off because they weren't able to manipulate him, Obama. It usually works. They find some garbage, blow it out of proportion, and watch their target make a fool out of himself trying to wiggle out of it. Barack didn't play their game. They're left with egg on their faces, and they're pissed. Good, Jane. Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. This is what media, especially television, is famous for. You know, pick at something, find something somebody said, and just pick at it until it starts to bleed, and then it starts to fester, and then it gets bigger like a bed sore, and you know that's exactly what they do. We were talking a few nights ago about the attack on Gary Condit. Remember him, the representative from California? And the only thing that got it off the air was the Twin Towers being bombed. Remember that? Ron and PA writes, Mike, it's not surprising that all the corporate cabin boys lack the emotional equipment not to go on the offensive to try to foment controversy as it concerns Obama's message of unity today. The populist content is sure to raise the ire of all those who identify with the power elite. They'll bark and slobber at anything that moves, at anything that intimates a sense of generosity toward those who have been scarred, dehumanized, and held down by poverty or racism and out-and-out criminal malfeasance. But what was more stirring and disturbing in the speech was the notion of healing the wounds of class warfare, which is sure to make him dangerous in the eyes of those who make a lot of cash off this kind of division. I've heard more than one African-American express concern and a sense of resignation that he may be assassinated for his seeking the presidency, let alone challenging the hierarchy. This reminds me of one of the contentions in Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, where he claims the Declaration of Independence was, in essence, a land-grab document. Likewise, he suggests that the Constitution could be seen as a way to create a wedge between poor whites and blacks and others who wish to enjoy the fruits of their newfound liberty, too. Many at the time feared that this coming together would undermine the establishment of a government sure to deliver a lion's share of the booty from the Revolutionary War to these self-same landowners. For together, the so-called rabble would be an unstoppable force and their will would surely prevail. Obama's candid and heartfelt oration, which seems to challenge this wicked part of our cultural history, makes him a liability to some and a godsend to others. I pray he survives what is sure to be a vicious and pathological response to his words. And I pray the foreboding of my fellow Americans doesn't play out in yet another pathetic state funeral that will surely reiterate the message that we plebes need to shut up and go back to work. Yeah. And this is the last one. Subject, this is from Charles, Southern Fairfield County, Connecticut Bureau Chief and Nova M Founders Club member. Subject line, a movement has begun, thoughts on Obama's speech. And Charles writes, did you hear the stench of right-wing fear today? You had to look for it. The corporate media is willing to control the discussion of it, but they were not willing to air it live. The press will be willing to guide your brain as to how you will process what your lying eyes heard. But those that heard it live, as it happened, well, moments never occur by design. Jesus never said, I'm creating a new religion. Come worship with me. He went around and spoke his peace in defiance of the powers that be, and a movement began. John Lennon did not design the Beatles to be the crux of the cultural change of the 60s. He just wanted to be in a really good rock band and believed in his heart that they were headed for the topmost of the charts, or toppermost of the poppermost, as he said. But a movement began. Vietnam started as a corporate means to make a killing via war. The intent was never to empower youth to force the hand of government to stop a war, but a movement began. Jesus was not Jesus until after the movement, when he became Jesus. Nor was John Lennon or Martin Luther King Jr. what they were to become until the movement carried them upon its air. One never knows when one is truly witness to history until long after it happens. Only then can we say, oh, I remember that. That was the speech that gave birth to a movement. Well, a movement started today. As all such movements, it was merely via words. The proper words at the proper time have the unique capacity to move people in ways they never intended. There has been a plethora of speeches regarding race for eons. Most try to explain the anger and frustration of the oppressed or try to justify the violence of the oppressor. Not until today were both sides so eloquently addressed and neither condemned. What was condemned was the continued allowing of corporations and those who make their living spewing divisive hate. Barack Obama's speech today will not cure our racial ills, nor would his presidency correct every wrong done in the last 8 years, but despite any leanings he might have had, in whatever plans he truly has laid out, a movement was started today. Obama dared for the first time to enter the wound and, with humility, showed it all to us. And he asked, do we really want to keep complaining about the symptoms of the wound, or can we move on and begin a healing? Those on the right no longer can use race effectively in this campaign. The issue has been addressed in full. That is the stench of their fear that you heard today. The speech will not be the cure, but the speech moved the garbage out of the way enough to show that there is a window where we did not see it before. Let's open the window. Let's have fresh, new air disinfect the wound. Let change occur because a movement has begun. Charles. Well, I hope you're right, Charles. I hope you're right. Is this Charles? Oh, there's Charles. Charles is on the phone, for God's sake. Hey, Charles, welcome to the program.
And you read me rather well.
Oh, well, good.
The thing about the movement is no movements continue by the person who personifies them. It's up to everybody else who is swept into it.
Right, right.
And the problem with the American mentality is, as I said in a previous call, we don't do maintenance.
Yeah.
So, you know, if everybody's looking for him to say, okay, we've got him as the nominee, we've got him as president, problem solved. Far from it.
Right.
But he's shown the wound that dare not be seen.
Mm-hmm.
He did something that, in no speech that I know of, in regards to race, he gave both sides and said, there is a righteous indignation, and neither side is wrong here. And he's in a unique spot to have both sides, because, you know, he's only half black, as Groucho Marx would said about his daughter being, she's only half Jewish, can she go into the pool up to her knees? He's got a foot in both worlds, so he knows whereof he speaks.
Yeah, that was the point I was trying to make early on in the program tonight, that irony of ironies, it's not so ironic when I stop and think about it, but here's a person who happens to be Barack Obama who could really, how can a multiracial person be criticized for making statements that seem to be an appeal to racial healing? I'm sure they can be, but it's a lot more difficult than criticizing or getting funky with a complete white person or a complete black person who tries to make the same appeal. Because you can always say, well, you know, because you're white or because you're black, you have an agenda. Barack Obama is transcends that. He reaches across that gap, with a white parent and a black parent. How in the hell is either side going to say he's ours? It takes both sides at this point, Charles, to say he's ours if somebody wants to claim him. But black folk can no more claim Barack Obama than white people. I'm sorry. I know I said that something similar to that a few weeks ago and got all kinds of nasty emails from folks who say, how dare you try to identify Barack Obama? He can identify himself. I'm not trying to identify him. I'm just saying how do white folk or black folk claim a man who, as Charles points out, has got one foot here and one foot there? I mean, a movement was born. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Get to appreciate the beauty of grace.
It's at the end of the tunnel. Sometimes the journey's long. There are many theories. Who's right and who's wrong? Precious own, I have to choose. I've got nothing to lose.
21 past the hour. Vince writes in, hi Mike, please relay this story to your listeners. I remember about 20 years ago living in East Lakeview in Chicago, better known as Wrigleyville. We were one of the first black families to move on North Clark Street in 1977. My nephew of 8 or 9 years of age was playing in the alley in back of our house, the house that we owned. The child had a toy gun playing in the alley, and along came this cop ready to draw his weapon on an 8-year-old black child. By the grace of God, I was there to stop this policeman from possibly shooting my nephew. Just another day of being black in America. Yeah, stories like that, they just go on and on. Black folk have, some have found a way to turn it into humor. You know, the DWB, driving while black, and so on and so forth. But it's the thing for us, isn't it? It is the thing in this country, the big divider, the big lump in the throat, the wound, as a couple of our listeners have written in tonight. It just sits there, and I've thought about it all my life, because my lifespan happens to encompass all the landmark civil rights legislation that was passed in this country in the past 50 years, and I've watched with how those bills were passed by some members of Congress with good intentions. Of course, other ones voted in favor of civil rights legislation in a very cynical way, either to get reelected or to be able to tell the folks back home something this or something that. But what has astonished me is to see how almost every single piece of that legislation, with the exception of public accommodations acts, have failed. Have absolutely failed. I'm talking mostly about education. You know, the resegregation of the public schools, brought about because of the economic impact and of all these jobs that have gone out of the country starting in the Clinton years, and really accelerating here in the 8 years of Bush. But as one of the emailers said tonight, you know, Barack Obama is addressing a class issue. He's addressing the fact that if we could ever get past hair texture and face features and skin color, we would find out that working class Americans, middle class Americans, whether middle class Americans know it or not, they're being put in a trick bag just over and over and over again, just constantly. You know, Obama got into this not this time. You know, we can move past this. You know, we don't have to be put in the joke bag again, not this time. And I, you know, I truly wonder. You know, some of the slogans that they were left over. Like, bread left out on the counter overnight. You wake up in the morning, it's all hard and crusty. You know, like, no peace, no justice, no peace. Boy, that one used to piss off white people. Woo! It still does. No justice, no peace. What are you talking about? This is America. You have justice? What's the matter with you, black person? You have justice. What are you talking about? And not being able to understand those simple four words. No justice, no peace. Are you threatening me? Is that a threat? I said a long time ago, I've said on this program, I know y'all get tired of hearing it, had I been born black in this country, you wouldn't be listening to this program right now, because I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have been here 40 years ago. I would have been in prison or dead or in a mental institution. Because I don't think I could have endured what black folk in this country have been asked to endure. I really don't. I just don't. And I know that a lot of what we're talking about tonight is just irritating the bejesus out of an awful lot of white people. And probably some blacks, too, are sitting there going, well, you know, there goes Malloy again, talking like he understands us. No, I'm not. I'm not talking like I understand you at all. I'm talking like I understand me where it concerns you. That's all I am talking about. I would never presume to come up with that kind of arrogance. Yeah, I understand. I've paid attention in my life. I've watched. I can talk about the old black ladies who would stand out in the rain at the bus stop with those shopping bags waiting for a bus to take her home to her children after she'd been tending white children all day. I can talk about that. I've seen it. I've witnessed it. I can talk about how the only way white people are ever going to understand blacks, the way blacks understand us, is to spend a couple of generations taking care of white babies and white old people, changing the diapers on 8-month-old and changing the diapers on 87-year-olds. Then, you know, but that's not going to happen, is it? We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Now we don't act real. And every living moment got a sing in the blues. A sole provider can't afford the baby shoes. That's the cycle so many of us go through. America's black holocaust continues. And I just hope we wake up soon before we fold. I miss the days of old.
Primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Back to your phone calls. Mel is calling from Virginia, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Mel, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm not a Barack Obama supporter,
mm-hmm.
so to say, but his speech about Jeremiah Wright kind of made me think about things a little bit. You know, he did bring up some things about white America too, and kind of made me think.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first person of black descent that's ever brought up the fact that it, well, maybe not necessarily the fact, but brought up that there was some racial discrimination against white men, too.
Well, it's not, I don't think it's racial discrimination against white people or against white men. It's discrimination, but it's brought about by the same people who control the power and can decide what's going to happen to black families and white families. And that is the elite in this country. I hate to keep harping on the word corporate America, but when you get right down to it, with the economy tanking and these predatory bastards continue to walk away with their multi-million-dollar separation packages, it's almost impossible for a white person to experience racism in this country. You may come into contact with a black person or a Latino or an Asian person who doesn't like you because of your race, and that would be racism. But it's few and far between. Let's keep it real, Mel. It's very few and far between where white people ever experience true racism. Racism, by definition, has to be put in place by the people who define the terms. And black people, Asian people, Native American people, Latino people have never defined the terms in America. It's always been white people who wrote the dictionaries and wrote the glossaries and decided what's going to be what weighs up, what weighs down, what weighs sideways, who's white, who's black. You see what I'm saying? I'm not trying to be argumentative with you, but you understand what I'm saying? I've heard a lot of whites, and I don't know your race, but I've heard a lot of whites say, well, you know, I felt racism too. And I just want to say, no, you haven't. You might have felt some discrimination based on something, but you have never felt racism because you're white. That's all. You understand what I'm saying? I'm not trying to pick a fight with you. You understand what I'm saying, Mel?
I understand what you're saying. I'm okay. A white male too. And,
okay.
And I can't say that in my area and where I live, I would like to say that most of the black people and white people in this area, we all get along. And there's not too many, well, not too much racial discrimination. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of black friends. Now, that's not to sound like a cliche.
No.
I do have some friends that are black. And a lot of them, you know, talk about. And this is one thing I wanted to say. The one thing that does bother me in this country is the fact that, well, maybe it's not necessarily a fact, and maybe this could be considered a cliche, is the fact or the opinion, I should say, of America that, and I don't want to say this and sound racist or even wrong by saying this, but it just seems like to me sometimes that, We always go back to, I know, as a white male, I'm 34 years old, mm-hmm. Okay? When I went through school, I want to say by the time I went through first, second grade in this area where I'm from, that when I went to elementary school, there was the school that I went to was predominantly white. And, I want to say, and this was, we're talking about 1979, 1980, 81, that in this area, you know, I lived in the city.
Okay, Mel, let me interrupt you because we're going to have to speed it up here. You were getting
Wait a minute.
You were getting close to saying something,
okay,
and then you did a complete U-turn and walked away from
it. Sorry.
Go back to that thing that you wanted to say, but you're afraid it'll sound racist. Just say it.
The only thing is that the only thing that upsets me with today's society, I know we talk about civil rights and all that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I know we and the black community talks about slavery. And I as a white man, I apologize totally. But I personally, nor my generation or anyone alive today
ever owns slaves.
I don't feel like it's responsible for that anymore, and
right.
I would honestly
all right,
like
let me try to
I
get
would
it.
Just like to move on. That's all.
Yeah, I hear you, and that's a good point, Mel. But let me show you where white people lose it. This is where the argument breaks down for Caucasians. I never owned slaves either, Mel. I'm not responsible for the Middle Passage either. You know, I didn't have a plantation down here in South Georgia. But let me show you where white people are responsible. This was a government-sanctioned gig, slavery. This was something that the government of the United States allowed to happen from the very beginning. The Constitution of the United States, while it didn't directly address slavery, the framers of the Constitution were, if I remember, most of them were slave owners, and some of them felt bad about it. But the whole idea of slavery and then Jim Crow laws, these were laws. The laws weren't written by you or me. That's right. But they were government sanctioned. The government has been in the hands of white people since day, by God, one. Since before day one. The government of the United States. The parameters of that government were determined by white people. There is no black man who is included in as a signer of the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence. To my knowledge, there was no black man who helped write the Constitution. Now, the fact is, I think one of the first people who died in the War of Independence in this country was a man named Crispin Attucks, I think that was it, who died in the so-called Boston Massacre. I think six people died in that confrontation with British troops. But the fact that the government of this country has been white for 200 and some years, and the fact that racism was institutionalized, that's where white people have an obligation. Not me personally, hell no. Not you, Mel, no. We're talking about, though, a government that only in the past 30 years, 40 years, max, have started to address this. And don't talk to me about, I'm not referring to you, Mel, I'm talking about to the racists out there saying, well, what about Abraham Lincoln? You know, don't talk to me about that, okay? Because that that ended, at least on paper, the institution of slavery. But it had nothing to do with denying black people rights that white people have had since Plymouth, by God, Rock. You understand what I'm saying? Now, this is a hard point for white people to get around. Kathy and I got into this discussion today about reparations. You know, and I said, you know, that's why, to me, the idea of reparations, while it's a pretty touchy subject, is not one that I find that we can't deal with on some level. For the reasons that Barack Obama said, for the reasons that most people understand, the denial of black families of the right to build wealth, the right to own land, the right to this and that and this and that. And Kathy's question, well, where would the money go? Who's going to decide? Well, it's very simple. White power establishment government decided on the one drop rule a long time ago. Barack Obama is considered a black man, no matter what he calls himself. He's considered a black man by American society. He has a white parent and a black parent, but he's a black man. So as far as reparations, how that would ever be handled, well, let's take a look at the Holocaust. The people who had their lives taken away from them, their possess everything stolen, and yet there are Holocaust not reparations, but attempts have been made over the past 30, 40 years to at least give back to those people the things that were taken from them. They can't give back the lives of their family members of the 6 million that were executed. But there is a way to do this. Let the black community, let black foundations, let African-American organizations make those determinations. White people do not have any business making those determinations about who would be responsible, or I mean, who would be on the list of people, the families, the descendants of slaves to receive reparations or what amount or what have you. You know, and I can fall back on the usual stuff and say, look, if we can spend $3 trillion killing Iraqis, is somebody going to tell me we couldn't spend $1 trillion or whatever it would take to set up a system of reparations to not right the wrongs, but I get caught up in my own rhetoric. We'll be back after a break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Nation, black and white discrimination, yeah, and you can't understand me, and all that other jazz they hand me, and my papers and TV, and all that mass stupidity that seems to grow more every day, each time you hear something we say, you want to go and do your in, cause the color of your skin, just don't appear.
A cafeteria line in Chicago. That man in front of me is calling black people trash to his children, when he's the only trash here I see. And I'm thinking this man wears a white coat in the night when his children should sleep. But they'll slip through their windows and they'll see. They'll think that white hood's all they need. Cause it's a hard life.
10 before the hour. Thanks to the Motley Crew again tonight. Ian Huff, who engineered the program and handled your calls. Billy Foster. Ben Birch, Chris in Minnesota, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, Catherine Bay is our executive producer. And if I haven't mentioned it lately, you can, and I'm asking you to become a Nova M founding member. You can get free downloads and podcasts when you want them. You also get access to special videos and additional features, including the video from the Phoenix event that Scott Ritter and I did in Phoenix, obviously, a couple of weeks ago. So if you're not a member, we'd like you to join up. Go to NovaMradio.com, and the information is there. It's, what is it, Kathy? $9.99 a month, $10 a month, or $100 a month, $100 a year. Yeah, I was saying $120. $100 a year, or $10 a month. So I hope you will join. Arnold is calling from North Carolina, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Arnold.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
I'm all right. How are you?
Doing your show tonight, man. That speech was just, oh, it just touched my heart, man.
I hear you.
I had tears in my eyes. I don't know what you. I had tears in my eyes, man. And I got to tell you, Mike, I'm firmly in the Obama camp, man. I was straddling the fence for a long time there. Mm. Then this racial thing got to going, and I just kind of, like, fell apart. Got even kind of even more to trust because I want this party to succeed. I want to get rid of this Republican nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
And but now I'm firmly in the Obama camp. And by the way, I'm trying to keep my voice down because I'm on the outer premises of the camp, and we're expecting a Clintonista bayonet charge tonight because they're going to strike back. They're going to strike back. Hey, what you tell Mel too, man? You know, you guys didn't own any slaves. Even though I am hooked on the Mike Malloy show, and if you and Kathy want to come up with some kind of reparations, I got my eye on a Cadillac Escalade. You know.
See, that is so nasty.
A nice Cadillac Escalade, a black. Accord,
yeah, I know, you know, I know, I know, I know, I know.
You know, I could give you a nice one like that.
Yeah, right, right.
Okay, those 20 acres of view, man. We gone way beyond that now. Okay.
Really?
Man, I enjoy your show. I'm not gonna hold you. I know you got some people trying to get some, you got a little bit of time. So, man, I mean, I'm in the camp now. I think we are at the point now. We got to go ahead and get this man in the office. He sees for everybody, and I don't know what else to tell you, Mike. Just we're on the gloom and doom of this economical thing that's going to come on us, and we need a man like this to bring us up. You know, I, as a black man, I'm willing to wait for him to come up with some kind of fantastic thing of reparation. I really don't care.
I hear you. No, I hear you. My feeling about Arnold is I think he's qualified to be president, or he wouldn't have come as far as he has. I think there is something innate in American consciousness that realizes he is capable. If you take a look at Ronald Reagan, what, you're going to tell me that Barack Obama is not more qualified than Reagan? Please. Gerald Ford, please. Richard Nixon, give me a break. George Herbert Walker Bush, get out of town. George W. Bush, get out of my face. So as far as whether or not Barack Obama is qualified, of course he's qualified. He's an American citizen. He's over the age of 35. That's about all you have to do, right? And be native born. He's qualified. Now, beyond his ability to surround himself with advisors who one would assume would not be the kind of corporate punks and thugs that George Bush has had, the ability of Barack Obama to surround himself with advisors who can begin the horrendously monumental situation that we're faced now with repairing this country domestically and our image overseas. Beyond all that, there is, for me, and I think this is the chord that Barack Obama has struck with a lot of people, there is the idea that maybe it's time to get beyond the garbage. Just get past it. And that includes the racial stuff. And it includes a genuine leader who is inspirational. When's the last time we had one who was really inspirational? I know for a lot of chuckle-headed white people, it was Ronald Reagan. Oh, they just loved him. Oh, he's a leader. He was a fool. He was good looking. And as long as he had everything written out for him, he was an actor, for Christ's sake. Of course he was able to pretend to be president of the United States. That was his job. In King's Row, he pretended to be a man that had no legs. So what? But I think Barack Obama, with his youth, with his energy, with his apparent willingness to try to solve things rather than bomb them, sit down and talk with people rather than call them ugly sons of bitches and then go try to kill them. I just think that this country is perched on the edge. Dear God, does anybody disagree with that? Let me see some hands. No, nobody disagrees with that. We're on the edge of a precipice. And it may take a Barack Obama to not just pull us back, but to lead us out of here. You understand what I'm saying? And I'm not a follower. But the right person comes along that says, look, this has got to stop. The right person comes along and says, not this time. Not this time. We're not going to do this again. Not this time. That's the person who's going to get my ear, and I'm going to listen to, and I'm going to vote for, and I'm going to roll the dice. I'll see you tomorrow night. Thanks for hanging out tonight. I appreciate it, okay? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.